Hello and welcome to Mercy Echoes, the official podcast of Mercy International Association, or MIA. My name is Brenda Drum and I am MIA's Head of Communications. We are an organisation of the leaders of Mercy congregations, institutes and federations throughout the world, founded to serve the Sisters of Mercy, their associates and partners in ministry. MIA has its base in Baggot Street in Dublin in the original House of Mercy opened by Catherine Macaulay in 1827. If you would like to get in touch with us about our podcast, you can email brendadrum@mercyinternational.ie. On this episode of Mercy Echoes, I am joined by Sister Anna Burke, a Sister of Mercy from Ireland who has just published her latest book, The Living Image. Sister Anna has a background in teaching, faith development, school chaplaincy and scripture reflection. She has authored several other books, including The Quality of Mercy and In the Secret of My Heart. She joined me to tell me all about her latest book and the importance of returning to the heart. But I began by asking her to tell me a little bit more about her life and ministry.
Thank you, Brenda. My life, starting at the beginning, I suppose, was very simple rural life in Ireland. We were lucky because we lived just about a mile from the village of Newtown Forbes. And there we had a primary school and a second level school. They were both run by the Sisters of Mercy. So in a time without transport, you were very lucky to have a bicycle. It was really, really convenient to be that close to education. And then after my leaving cert with the Sisters of Mercy, I joined the community there, and that took its course. After final profession, I was asked to go to Florida in the United States to a place called Palm Bay. Again, education. We engaged in parish work and we engaged in the school. After 10 years in Florida, I went to Zambia, and again, education, second level, and we did quite a bit of faith development in the local area. I spent a short while, a few months in South Africa, and then I came back to Ireland, and in Ireland, I was engaged in faith development in the Diocese of Ardent and Llanmacnoise. And I also had 5 years as a school chaplain. So, you know, covered a lot of territory, wide experience. That's more or less it.
That is quite, it's quite the CV that you have. And I was... I would know Newtown Forbes and Longford very well, where you're from. And did you attend both primary and secondary school with the Mercy Sisters?
I did, yes. Primary school and second level, yeah.
So you're a Mercy girl, absolutely, through and through.
I have to admit, yes. Yeah.
What was it like for you, Longford and Florida, especially Palm Bay? You probably couldn't get two more different places. What was it like for you to go there so soon after you were professed?
I suppose at a level, Brenda, a little bit exciting and a little bit worrying, you know. Where am I going? What will I be doing? Will I make it over here? And yet to see another side of the world was inviting. So a mixed feeling, but the experience and being there, meeting the people was fantastic. Yeah, really, you know, it's a great opportunity to grow and expand your thinking and, you know, your questions when you move out of your own culture. So, yeah, it was a very rewarding time.
And then from there, moving to somewhere like Zambia, which was different again, that must have been another world, really.
Yeah, another world, Brenda. Yes, another world. And took me a while to get my head around it. But I often said to people who talked to me about this that actually the greatest challenge for me was returning to Ireland after Zambia. And I do have a very clear memory of going into a supermarket in Ireland, and I couldn't go past the door with all the, so to speak, stuff, boxes and shelves of this, that, and the other. Having come from a place where you were very, very lucky to get flour and sugar. So that was a big, big adjustment. And it put a whole lot of questions in my mind.
What year was that when you returned from Zambia?
When I returned from Zambia, it was 1990, as far as I can remember.
So we were just starting to be on the up and up, as they say in Ireland, and that sense of moving into the boom time in Ireland, I suppose, at that stage. Yeah.
It didn't. It's an interesting experience, but for me, it didn't delight me to see all that Ireland had. It was a moment of sorrow that we could have all this stuff up to the sky, and that other people had nothing virtually. I
Yeah.
found that very, very challenging and difficult to cope with.
You've obviously been steeped in education from being that Mercy girl in primary and secondary school and working in education and faith development. Talk to me about how you ventured into writing and becoming a published writer.
I think, Brenda, I have to admit that there's something in my gene. I wrote from a very early age. I'm talking about scribbles now, and a sentence here and a sentence there. But I was always inclined to write wherever I was, whatever I was doing. And I'm talking now about a sentence, a comment, but I would write it whereas another person would speak it. So I just felt later on in life when I thought about the whole thing, I thought that there must be something in my gene. My father was a little bit like that also, different time, minimal education, but inclined to write. So something genetic maybe in it. Why did I write? You asked me, Brenda, why did I write
Or
at all?
how did you become a published writer? I suppose you've shared there your sense of always being inclined to write. Was that sort of writing for yourself, like journaling or putting a sentence, or did you write it to share with others?
Initially, journaling, just myself and the paper and the pen. But then, as I got into more formal work in faith development and so on, I wrote a number of reflections, liturgical reflections, and so on. And people would say to me, you should send that to School X. You should give that to Parish Y. So I'm getting this message, you should send this out. Instead of sitting at a desk writing it, at least share it with someone. And it was really from that veiled invitation, if you like, that I decided I wrote first locally and I got them printed myself. So you wouldn't call it publishing. Then I moved from that to publishing. And I remember my first book, I think it was 2007, was Sacred the Hour. And it was just reflections on the rosary and trying to call people into the plan of God as it is unveiled and released in the decades of the rosary. So that was my first book. And it did well,
Yeah.
well, in general terms, it did well. I didn't get an Oscar or anything, but it gave me confidence and it gave me courage to continue.
Want to get to your latest book. and your book that's hot off the press, and I have a copy of it here in my hands. It's called
Oh.
The Living Image: Returning to the Heart. Congratulations on it. What inspired you to prepare a text on the idea of returning to the heart?
Yeah. It's an interesting question and a difficult question. Living on the earth like everyone else, we all have at one level similar questions. In other words, what's going on and the fuss and the fume, and we're all run off our feet, and people are, very, very challenged about the bureaucracy in all the different professions. And as one young woman said, I entered the profession to become a whatever, and this is I'm spend my life at the computer. And that's a common statement. So, what did I, the living image of the heart. I was provoked by how could the heart solve the chaos, the madness, the blindness of our time? I mean, it seemed at one level a naive statement. But then, as I thought about it, and especially when I read the encyclical, Dilexit Knows, I really, really valued how Pope Francis approached the heart and how he offered the heart as the remedy, the core of all reality. And, we have so much about the heart and we say so much about the heart, and it's imaged in so many different ways that this encyclical brings the heart into the heart of reality. It opens the depth and the meaning of the heart. It just brings us to a new level of consciousness, this heart. So it was, as I read it was helping me with my own struggle questions.
You have a lovely line very early on in the book where you say, "Here in the stillness of hearing, we learn the meaning of giving our love in the service of life." And
Yeah.
we so often hear giving our life in the service of love, but it's interesting, giving our love in the service of life. I loved that phrase that you
Yeah,
shared.
yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you obviously this you mentioned Dilexit Knows, and today actually is the first time we're recording this today on the first anniversary of Pope Francis's death. So
Oh.
it's just a nice little
Yeah,
moment there.
that's nice. Yeah,
And
yeah.
one of the things that I found when I read your book, it's almost a roadmap of how to avoid being all consumed by, you mentioned it there, the fuss and the fume, the madness, the chaos, the blindness of our time,
Yeah.
and including all that surrounds us to do with artificial intelligence and the wall of images that we're inundated with on a daily basis. And I suppose, is there a bit of a cautionary tale in there as part of your narrative, do you feel, in terms
How
of
do I?
how we should be responding to the world
Well, I
today?
think, yeah, that's another big question, Brenda. But I
Yeah.
think we are all, in a general sense, we're all asking the same question, and it constantly hits me, the emptiness that comes with fullness. Like you can't get into our houses with, so to speak, stuff, and everything is up to the ceiling. So at one level, we have everything. We're full. At another level, we're empty. I was thinking of technology. It unites the world and separates the world. We are very far apart, and yet I can call you in Australia in a matter of minutes. So the word emptiness stays with me. I think it was part of my experience in Africa also, where people had very little, very, very little. Now, I know things have changed and life may have improved, but despite that little, great joy, great happiness, dancing in the streets, time for the neighbors, so on. A quality that we have let go with consumerism and all that goes with it. So emptiness stays with me. And what I liked about this encyclical, Pope Francis brought the image, the living image, the image of the Sacred Heart into reality, into how it can help us address our reality. As he said, race and, you know, fussing and fuming and not knowing why we're doing it.
And what are some of the things that you feel that we could be doing to return to the heart, to maybe fill up that emptiness with the right kind of things?
What could we be doing? Well, you and I could address it as individuals in our own room, but to address it universally or globally is another story because of the dominance and the power of money and productivity and all competition, all of that is dictating the pace and the culture. And it's very, very hard to address that as an individual person because the people who are heard are the powerful people. So unless the society raises up literally a prophet, prophetess, I don't see, and the prophet, prophetess have to have power and influence. Because that's the dilemma we're in. I also think that voices on the ground, like yours, like mine, need to find spaces. Even if you're talking locally, or even if you're talking to a local paper, things have a way of moving. But it's not acceptable for me to say, oh, that's President X's business. It's my business, and I have to find ways locally to have my voice heard.
I suppose it's that sense of that we're globalization, but at the same time, there's the global, like everything ultimately is local, and every something that is local can become, can spread around the world in minutes as well.
Like you reminded me of the words of the song, "Let peace begin with me. Let this be the moment now. Let it begin with me." And you know, instead of talking about countries and presidents and leaders, let it begin with me. So I think to take it back to and. You know, I often think of the crucifixion of Christ and the cry of crucify him. There was no one to step forward, and that was a significant crowd. There was no one to step forward and raise the other voice. I know you risk your life. No, I'm not, but I'm just saying that's common. You know, we don't speak out. Is it fear or is it that we don't think we'll get a hearing, that it's a waste of time. I don't know. I'd be, if in my own case, I'd be inclined to think it's a waste of time, but that can be a cop out.
There is also, you mention in your book as well, there is, while the international language and almost symbol of the heart connects us, that in a way we're living in an age where many people feel a bit numb. They're numbed to stuff and they don't know where to begin to address that.
We're numbed. I was thinking when you were speaking there of what causes numbness when you take the life out of a finger or a toe or a leg. So if the life is gone, numbness sets in. And if the society is empty, numbness sets in. and to take the image, the living image of the Sacred Heart, out of the society because you say it's old-fashioned or it's nostalgic or it has nothing to say to us today. First of all, it's missing the point. Secondly, it's a failure to inhabit the image, to extract from the image what it is telling us. And I was thinking of the Last Suppers. That's Leo, Michelangelo, Leo, who's Leo?
Leonardo da Vinci, yeah.
Leonardo da Vinci. I wasn't sure whether it was Michelangelo. Anyway, but that great image that has lived forever, so to speak, what is it saying? Why do we keep images of loved ones forever and ever and ever? Why do we sit looking at them? The memory, the message, the connection, the relationship. So this image of the Sacred Heart is not just a symbol. It's a reminder of the divine human relationship. And that's what I liked about the encyclical. Without that reminder, we fall into emptiness. And in the emptiness, we're all numbed.
It was a very interesting choice by Pope Francis for his, but he probably knew this would be his last encyclical. And
It was an
it was a deliberate choice, I would say.
I would say a very deliberate choice because coming from all his experience with people and nations and institutions and so on, he had a lot of material to go on. And like all of us, as you know, we have all said, what's the solution to this? How in the name of goodness can this be resolved? So when you sit with that question, it's rather amazing that he came up with the answer of the heart, this core of all reality is the heart. That's what he said. And unless we return to the heart, as you said, we remain numb.
And of course, people might not know what Dilexit Knows means.
Yeah, it means he loved us based on Romans chapter 8. A woman said to me when we were talking about this initially, why did he say he loved us? Why didn't he say he loves us? So there you are. All authors have their reasons for their titles, but I just try to think of it as the Pope was talking about the story of this person and how it is recorded and how we can read it. And that's the person who loved us. It doesn't take from loving, you know, but I take her point was very valid.
Now, your book is, without including references, it runs to 98 pages. So it's a very accessible book that you can pick up and read in a chapter and put down. Who do you hope will read it? And maybe not just read it, but who do you hope will use your book?
I see it, Brenda, as a teaching tool. I see it as a resource that we could use with adults, obviously, but with young adults. It provides, I believe, a space for questions, for conversation on the deeper issues of life. For me personally, it's a service, and I think it's an obligation, although I don't particularly like that word, but our commitment to Christianity and to the living image asks of us to bring this to the emerging generation, to I remember going to a lecture, oh, good few years now, and essentially the point was that it's an injustice. It's kind of robbing young people of their rights not to discuss the deeper issues of life and living. They weren't saying evangelize. They weren't saying, tell them this is what they have to do. Not at all. But they were saying, if you haven't religious education, you're not educated. It's part of the educational ladder. You have to, even if you reject it and reject everything about religion, you have to know at a certain level, or you're not educated. I thought it stayed with me, as an important point.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it's that I haven't heard it described as almost robbing people, young people, of their rights not to discuss the deeper questions. And I remember somebody a few years ago saying that we shouldn't be dumbing down what we're offering in the context of faith to young people. Young people want to be challenged and they're able to be challenged, and we should be challenging them with the deeper questions.
And they have the same hunger, the same longing as we all have, and not to nurture that, develop it, grow it, evolve it, at least allow the space for questioning and conversation, it is a failure on our part.
Your book is called The Living Image Returning to the Heart. It's published by Messenger Publications, and we'll put the links up. And I know this is a very, very unfair question, but what's next? What's percolating as your next book?
Well, there is something percolating, but when it will come to the boil, I don't know. I'm thinking of the Eucharist, Brenda, because I know Pope Francis refers to it many times as, the high point of the living image, the deepest expression of the heart. Again, it's a humble effort to take it out of the ordinary words we use all the time and invite the deeper questions, the challenging questions. It's like going to the depths of the ocean, as apart from flapping on the top of it, So, and I think I often said to myself, it was Ilia Delio who said, "What happened between God and Christ and humanity is the future of the world." So I think we talk about the church and fewer priests and all the challenges and closing and so on. The heart of the matter is the Eucharist for me.
We'll be watching out for that, and we won't hold you to any deadline. But Anna, it's been wonderful to chat to you, and to I could spend the whole day listening to you. You've given me so much food for thought, and no doubt our listeners so much food for thought. I would encourage people to pick up the book. I have it, and I've read a couple of your others as well, and I'm always left wanting more and with more questions, which I think is good. So thank you so much for being with us on Mercy Echoes, and you keep writing and keep journaling, and most of all, keep sharing with the Mercy world and the rest of the world.
Thank you very much, Brenda. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
That was Sister Anna Burke coming to us from County Longford in the Irish Midlands. Anna's book is available from Messenger Publications, www.messenger.ie. If I was to take one thing from that interview, it would be what Sister Anna said about the emptiness that comes with fullness. At one level, we have everything, but at another level, we are empty. It's food for thought. So that's it for episode 12 of Mercy Echoes. I hope that you've enjoyed our chat. We will be back with you soon with more voices from the Mercy world. Do give us a follow on Spotify. In fact, why not hit subscribe so as the next episode will land in your inbox. You can find out more on our website, mercyworld.org. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch to suggest a theme or a guest from the Mercy World that we invite onto the podcast, please drop me an email, brentadrum@mercyinternational.ie. Don't be afraid to suggest yourself. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.